Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Fixed Income Conversation Corner podcast series right here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we are excited to welcome back to the program from Richard Bernstein Advisors, RBA, Mike Kontopoulos, Deputy Chief Investment Officer and Director of Fixed Income. And then, of course, as always, joining us here from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas, Leslie Falconio. So with that, Mike, Leslie, thank you both for dropping by, spending some time today with our listeners, our clients. Leslie, let me pass it off to you to lead today's conversation with Mike. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Mike, for being on. The last time you and I were on together, we were on media, so it's always good to have conversations with you. I know you've been on this podcast many times before, and I think the timing here will be really great in terms of conversation. So thanks again for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Leslie. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So, listen, I wanted to sort of dive in, and when we think about it, fixed income, let's reflect, you know, we're almost in November, we're heading towards the end of the year. Why don't we sort of do a quick reflection, if you will, in terms of, you know, fixed income performance this year, given all the, you know, not only political rhetoric, but, you know, what's happened in terms of performance and yields, domestic and globally. And as we think about those returns, you know, now that we have 2 months left, how should we think about fixed income, you know, into year end, and what maybe the performance drivers might actually be given the uncertainty that we still have in the market?
Sure. You know, it's been obviously, Leslie, as you know, quite a good year in fixed income. I mean, when I was looking at the performance sheet this morning for our own strategies, it was pretty amazing to see that the 3-year annualized market returns in fixed income are almost 6.5%, which is crazy. It's a real asset class again, which obviously never seemed like it was going to be, you know, in the depths of 2022. But not only this year, it's really the last couple of years have been quite strong, and this year obviously no exception to that. It's been a great year, along with a lot of other assets out there, as we all know. You know, whether it's AI, you know, and the backbone of that with technology, China, crypto, meme stocks, unprofitable companies. I mean, we've seen a boom, I would say, in speculation. Some of that speculation has benefited, in my view, fixed income, particularly in the credit markets and corporate credit in particular. And I know we'll get into that later. But for now, year to date, I mean, listen, those 7-8% returns that you've realized in several of the sort of broader asset classes, mortgages, corporate credit, et cetera, is really unbelievable. I mean, it's rivaling equity-like returns historically, and you know, I don't, and rates haven't really fallen that much yet. And so it's been a pretty wild year. Very exciting to be a fixed income investor here with the potential for real return. And quite frankly, I don't think that's going to stop. You know, I think about over the next couple months, which is unbelievable to think that we only have 2 months until the end of the year. But I think fixed income is going to continue to hang in there pretty well. The only, I think, stumbling block that you could potentially see is a spread widening event. But, of course, every day that goes by, that becomes less and less likely as you inch closer and closer to your end. So I think this year is going to be a very, very good year in fixed income. I think we're going to continue to clip coupons. Unfortunately, you're not going to get much more price appreciation from here to year end, but you don't need to end up with a high single digits type return 2025.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree with you, Mike. And it's interesting, too, because when people talk about, you know, listen, spreads are tight, right? I know you and I are going to talk about the pocket of vulnerability that we're currently seeing right now in some of the markets, but since spreads have been outside of the, you know, April volatility, you know, spreads have been actually quite muted. They haven't really moved around a lot in terms of either higher quality or the higher credit embedded sectors. And that opportunity for carry, you know, the opportunity for that price appreciation that we have seen, and we completely agree that, you know, our outlook for us in 10 years are around a 375 longer term. So it's not as though people are going to get a tremendous amount of price appreciation from yields coming down, because our view is that we have these sort of non-recessionary cuts. But it has been a great year for fixed income. We think that carry is still going to still be a tailwind to total return. But I wanted to shift to, you know, sort of the Fed here as we think about, you know, just I'll tell you the CIO's outlook of non-recessionary cuts and the outlook of slowing but, you know, trend-like growth, which, you know, a lot of forecasters were not anticipating originally, right? People thought it would slow tremendously, and we're really just not seeing that, and the resilience is really showing through. But when we think about the September cut, which has occurred, but the market is pricing in, it seems to be fairly dovish, right? It's pricing in that terminal rate around 3.80, you know, 2.8 to 3%. Sorry, 2.8 to 3%, which that 3% might be the terminal, but as fixed income markets have a tendency to do, they're pushing it forward and they're being quite speculative. What do you think in terms of, you know, the meeting next week, given the lack of data that we're seeing, and just given the fact that the market is really saying, hey, this is what we're expecting from the Fed over the next, say, 6 to 8 months?
Yeah, so, Liz, I'll ask you really quickly, that 375 10-year, that's a longer-term estimate for UBS, correct? Like, what, like a 2020 and 2026 type?
Correct. That's correct. That's a potential for the 2026, and that's sort of where we see that floor in yields right now because we are not looking for a hard landing.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. I would actually, it's always hard for me to forecast a year from now, but here's what I think is a pretty reasonable chance of happening over the next, say, 1 to 6 months. What I think is likely to happen or has a very high probability of happening is that the Fed cuts next week. And inflation comes in hotter than expected. We know GDP now is actually quite strong. We don't have labor data. Labor data is certainly weakening, but it's not weak, right? And it's not entirely, I don't want to overstate the importance, but it ends up being a mistake type moment for the Fed. And certainly a mispricing of Fed expectations from the market. And what ends up happening is with higher inflation and labor that isn't completely rolling over, you actually get higher rates rather than lower rates over the near term. And I think that's sort of, you know, a very realistic chance. You've never had this easy financial conditions in the history of, since, you know, records had been kept, with this high of inflation. And we tend to be in the inflation camp. You know, we don't think that it's entirely transitory. We think tariffs are inflationary. Maybe not as inflationary as we would have thought in April. I think corporates are actually taking it more on margins than passing it through to customers, at least so far. But they're certainly inflationary, and you can certainly see in the data that inflation has started to tick upwards since April. And so I think that, you know, the Fed, it rhymes quite a bit with September of last year. The Fed was concerned about labor as the SOM rule was tripped, if you recall. Earnings growth was pretty strong. Inflation was nowhere near target, hanging around 3%+. All very similar things to what we see today, yet the Fed cut anyway. And what happened? The 10-year went from 375 to 475. I do think we're going to rhyme with that. And whether it's 425 or 450 or 475 again, I'm not entirely sure. But I think we should expect cuts to actually lead to higher rates in the near term. Now, longer term, call it a year, that's a different story. And we can't, you know, we don't have to get into that today, but yeah, you know, I think longer term probably the trend is lower on the 10-year, but not over the next 1 to 3 months.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I think I'm really glad that you brought that up because I will say, I mean, our target for the end of this year for 10-year treasury yields was about 4%. But actually, a lot of what you said in terms of our positioning, we agree with you in the sense that since we've hit that 4% target a little bit early, because of, in our view, the market is speculating on what the you know data may show in terms of, say, softening labor market, and we completely agree. We think it's cooling, not cracking. We've actually taken some of this opportunity to actually shed some interest rate risk here, simply because, you know, even with the potential of 375 in, you know, 2026, it's not going to be like a straight line down and stay there, right? Given where we are right now in particular, the how much you could go down versus how much you have the potential to rise in the short term, I think exactly to your point, you know, it leads towards being a little bit more defensive here on the interest rate exposure side. And we completely agree with that notion. when we think about how...
And to that point, Leslie, you know, I think I'll just throw out there that, you know, this doesn't mean run away from duration in our view completely. Like, our duration, for example, is roughly 5.3 years. I mean, for context, the market's duration as defined by the Bloomberg Ag is closer to 6.2. So we're about a year underweight duration. So this is not a scream for the hills type event, but I think that's right. The balance of risks have probably shifted to higher rates rather than lower rates from here.
We completely agree. So I want to talk to you about, let's just talk about what we're seeing in the market today. And there's sort of two questions I want to put in here. You know, one of the reasons, as you and I were just discussing, that some of these yields are coming down, particularly with the lack of data, is because of this headline risk that we've seen within the credit market. And we know that sentiment, poor sentiment, could last for a while, right? Even if the fundamentals are strong, when sentiment starts to turn negative, you know, it could last for a bit. And we don't want to excuse everything necessarily idiosyncratic or one-off and completely ignore what's happening within the credit markets now. But our view is that fundamentals are still strong, but negative sentiment could last for a bit. Like, how are you playing this in terms of, or what is your view about the sentiment today, and how could that potentially feed into growth, meaning that is the market right with these lower yields and possibly slower growth? Is it overestimating the potential of the resilience of the economy? Just curious of your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is where the sort of the short-term horizon differs a bit from the medium-term horizon in our view. So the short-term, I think, again, I'll call short-term 1 to 3 months, is you get an easier Fed next week, you get higher interest rates, that starts to panic markets a little bit, particularly equity markets that are overheated, areas of the equity markets that are overheated. So think your AI-type, unprofitable tech companies, et cetera, right? In a way, this potential rise in interest rates that we just discussed is the market's way of tightening financial conditions without the Fed having to do anything, okay? And I think we are starting to see cracks in credit markets. I mean, we know we are on the low-end consumer. You look at subprime mortgages or subprime auto loans, et cetera. And I think you're starting to see it in private lending. I think you're starting to see it in leveraged loans. You know, you're seeing some of the lowest recovery rates in history in the leveraged loan market. You're seeing defaults start to accelerate within private credit. Not the high levels, but you're starting to see one-offs. When you get too many one-offs, in my view, they're no longer one-offs. It reminds me very much of 2015 when retail was under stress in the high-yield market, and I'd go out and I would talk to portfolio managers, and, you know, oh, it's just retail, and retail's just 3% of the market. And then retail became, oh, it's retail and materials, and it was retail, materials, and energy, and it was retail, materials, energy, and industrials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of all of a sudden is, you know, the, oh, it's just becomes 80% of the market. I think we're in the very beginning stages of that. I really do. And to those who think, oh, you know, this is one-off fraud, et cetera, what I would say is you've had exceptionally easy monetary policy and easy financial conditions, and that's the breeding ground for excess and fraud. Now, why this matters is because it doesn't necessarily all hit at once. This might be a mid-26, late-26, 2027 type, you know, issue by the time it all comes to a head. But I do believe we are seeing the beginning cracks. I don't really buy that there's such thing as, you know, one-off when you have multiple examples over a period of a reasonably short period of time like we've had recently. So it's a little bit of conflict of this stronger growth now begetting tighter financial conditions because of the market's repricing of risk and rates, ultimately leading to more stress within the credit market, of which the most recent stress was just the canary in the coal mine.
So when we think about that in terms of, let's take a look at the shape of the yield curve, right? You know, our position has been since probably mid-24, after years of inversion. You know, we had the steepening bias on. We've kept the steepening bias on. You know, as of late, we know that, you know, part of the reversal that we've seen, what we call the bull flattener, yields come down, the long it outperforms. A lot of this has been to speculation in regards to the data that we're not seeing, or to your point, those that believe that, say, you know, the credit market correction that we're seeing is not a one-off and it could lead to actual slower growth or maybe have issues down the road. How do you see the yield curve over the next, say, 6 months? Are you still on the flattening side, slower growth, you know, maybe, you know, are you more of the steeper will start to trend back into place like it has been for the past, you know, 8-9 months?
Yeah, I think probably steeper over the next, you know, 3 to 6 months for the reasons we mentioned earlier. Fed that right now has a bias of cutting should anchor the front end, if not even, you know, bring it down a touch. And then, you know, if we're right on inflationary pressures and growth holding in better than most expect over the next 1 to 3 months, then, you know, the long end should feel pressure and you get the steepening. As you get closer to 3 to 6, I think you could start to make a case for slowing, for flattening, but it really depends on what's going on with labor, what's happening with inflation, you know, what's happening with growth. If growth is starting to, you know, slow more than what's expected, if that starts to bring down inflation, if you see labor really weakening, then you may see the flattening in a 3 to 6 month horizon, or maybe a 6 to 9 month horizon. But I think more near term, over the next 1 to 3 months, I think you probably see more steepening in the yield curve. Because of that lack of confidence, for what it's worth, right now in our portfolios, we are not making a yield curve view. You know, we did earlier in the year. We had a steepener that worked really, really well. We kind of lifted off that steepener mid-year, and since then have been pretty much curve neutral. And instead, you know, making our, you know, our play for alpha more from an underweight in credit than explicit duration or curve play.
So when we think about the underweight in credit, and I know you and I have spoken about this when we were on media together, but, you know, just from the how snug the corporate credit side is versus, say, part of the securitized product, which is not as influenced via the equity market or what we're seeing in terms of, you know, either lending activity or what we're seeing in some of these, you know, specific issues that have occurred over the past, you know, month or so. I know we were both fans of the agency MBS side as a high quality sector, given the relative value. I'll tell you right now, we still have that. We're still fans of it. We still have it as an attractive position in our view. Just curious if your thoughts have changed or how are you viewing the sector overall?
Yeah, we continue to like agency mortgages. I think they make a lot more sense than corporate credit. I wish spreads were wider. I think we both probably, overweighted the asset class at a time when spreads were, you know, a little bit more attractive than they are today. They've had a wonderful year so far. But I continue to like them, you know, for a couple reasons. One is, agency mortgages at a broad market level, forget about, you know, choosing individual spots. Like at a broad market level, you know, you can get agencies with the, you know, the government guarantee and, you know, little downgrade risk and great liquidity and everything else for the same yield as you can get the investment grade corporate bond market. So why take corporate credit risk when you don't need to get the same yield and with a couple of years less duration at that? And so, yeah, we still like agencies. We have a fair value model that suggests 98% of the time over a one-year horizon, agencies, when they trade where they do today, give you a positive return. And about 50 to 55% of the time, they outperform treasuries. So you'd like to see a bigger percentage of the time outperforming treasuries, but the total return potential is totally intact. Fundamentals so far intact. I do think we need to start thinking about how QT, the unwind of QT may affect mortgage spreads, the relative attractiveness versus treasuries. I think, you know, obviously questions about the IPOing of Fannie and Freddie and whether that's going to happen could affect spreads as well. So I think there's some questions out there that maybe didn't exist 2 or 3 months ago, but that we're looking at and thinking about the relative value consequences of all that. But for now, we still like agencies quite a bit and really, really don't like the corporate market from a relative value perspective.
That we agree. I mean, we were long IG corporates for quite some time. We actually took that more to a neutral view and have held the attractiveness in agency MBS. And I spreads have compressed. It's a long time coming, as we've spoken about, particularly since volatility has come down so much. They're definitely not as cheap as they once were, but I still think they offer that value. And particularly as the spotlight remains on the level of the 30-year mortgage rate, we know that the 10-year Treasury yield is only one component that dictates what that mortgage rate will be, and the second part is that spread. And I think that you're absolutely right in regards to the potential headwind of the IPO, but I also think that there's going to be some sort of measurement which keeps that sort of has that spread potential to compress, particularly as they focus on the level of mortgage rates, which is not just about the 10-year Treasury yield.
Yep.
And I wanted to also just end here, Mike, with when you think about positioning overall, and I want to let's sort of take it out just of the U.S. expand globally. We know things are happening in France and the JGBs and the U.K. And we had when our 30-year was rising, it was a global, rise in the back end interest rates. And, we have a lot that's coming up over the next couple months, whether it's a continued government shutdown or Supreme Court in regards to, tariffs and such. But I'm really curious as how you're viewing your overall positioning and where you see value over the next several months, whether it's domestic or abroad.
For now, it's still domestic. We still think there's enough opportunities here with agencies, as we mentioned, to get enough, the juice is worth the squeeze here in the U.S. I think there's another opportunity that we haven't spoken about today that is a fairly new opportunity for us. We initiated an overweight, by nature it's an overweight because they're not in the index. We initiated an overweight of municipal securities, in particular the long end of the muni curve, IG, of course. And, I think there's opportunity there as well for a lot of different reasons, whether it's, sort of the price appreciation we've seen and sort of the removal of the issues around the de minimis rule, whether it's retail kind of coming back into the long end of the curve, whether it's because you actually have some spread there that can absorb a little bit of interest rate risk should rates go up. We think the long end of the muni curve has had a really rough stretch for a very long time and presents some opportunities that, when I look around the world, as compelling as anything. One of the things that, just for your listeners so that they know, we do invest in emerging market debt. We've had emerging market sovereigns. We've had emerging market high-yield corporates even. But we always invest in dollars. So, a lot of times when I do these calls and I talk to investors, it's like, tell me about local debt, et cetera. We just don't feel like the FX volatility is worth it in a fixed income market. And so everything we do is on dollar terms. And when I look at markets across the world and on, hard currency debt, there's still plenty of options here in the U.S. that look attractive.
And, we agree, especially on the muni side. I'm actually glad that you brought that up because, the two sectors that were really laggards this year was the agency MBS and the muni side. I mean, muni is quite a bit more, and we're starting to see some recovery in both those sectors, agency MBS a little bit more, and there's definitely still a lot of value on that muni side. So we agree with you there as well. So if there's anything, Mike, I do appreciate you taking the time. And, what do you think in terms of, say, versus cash? I know you're also too in the belief that when we look at cash returns, and we know money market funds are at sort of like the highest AUM, they continue to grow. We believe the curve is steepened. We see that reinvestment risk within the cash market. Obviously, investors should always keep a portion of liquidity, but are you seeing that more like, people are starting to invest their cash into fixed income simply because of the reinvestment risk and particularly into higher quality to generate that sort of yield and compounding carry?
They're starting to, Leslie, but it I don't think the big flood of cash has happened yet. I still think cash rates are reasonably attractive for most. Once you get, or if you get, more Fed cuts and that starts to whittle away quickly, I think you'll get a bigger deluge of cash into fixed income. And we're seeing a little bit of that, but not to the extent that I think, we would all love to see in the fixed income market. So I think there's a lot still to come, but it's certainly a conversation I have with a lot of financial advisors. And financial advisors recognize that differential and the opportunity for total return in fixed income and how cash yields, you know, are likely to go lower, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it's coming. I don't know if it's entirely there yet, though.
Agreed. And I think until some of this volatility goes away, you'll probably have a little bit more of that to come, particularly going into, you know, the end of the year always sees an uptick in volatility, you know, whether it's balance sheet window dressing. And on top of this year, we're going to have, you know, a flood of data as the government reopens. And then mentioned we have things such as the Supreme Court coming up. So volatility is definitely going to be there at the end of the year. But I think to your point as well, I think it will create a decent amount of opportunity. So, Mike, thanks so much for hopping on. I really always enjoy the conversations with you, both on the podcast and in the media. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Likewise, Leslie. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.